Hello, comedy geeks, comedy nerds, friends of the funny. I'm Mike George.
And I'm Masavia Greer. Today on Comedy Anatomy, we have Dov Davidoff.
Dov is a stand-up comic and actor who you might have seen on HBO's Crashing with Pete Holmes, NBC's Shades of Blue with Jennifer Lopez and Ray Liotta. He's also been on Marin, The Chappelle Show, Chelsea Lately, and performed on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and the list goes on and on.
He also wrote a fascinating memoir called Road Dog, which is about life on the road as a comedian. Now enjoy our conversation with Dov Davidoff.
Dov Davidoff, welcome to Comedy Anatomy.
Yes, sir.
Yes, good to meet you, Dov.
You are in New York, right, Dov?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I wasn't always, but right now I am.
Yeah, I know for a while you were in LA, and I was remembering, you know, watching you work out and watching you develop. But at the same time, let's know the Dov before you started comedy. Like, what was your...
I wrote a memoir about life before this, but it was, you know what it was? It was just, like a lot of people that get into comedy, I came from a strange environment. It was, you know, my mother was, where the fuck does it start? I grew up in a junkyard in Jersey, but my mother was a hippie sort of intellectual with the Columbia. She was on her way to teach piano in India when she stopped off to meet my father, who was an uneducated Jewish business guy from the street. And my mother was wrapped up in a post-apocalyptic commune upstate where they were convinced that the end of the world was coming, but that they would be protected by a force field.
So wait a minute. So your dad, when you say you grew up in a junkyard, because you see junkyards, but what does that really mean? Are you near it? Are you actually physically spending time?
Across the street, there was a dirt driveway, and then across the street is the junkyard. But it was, it was just an odd place, environment. You know, when you hear Springsteen writing songs about their factory kind of towns and places, yes, and that psychology. Yeah, you know, but sort of rough working class environment for the most part. And then, you know, I had to figure out how to work through my own mind in that world. And then you end up, I think, finding humor as a way to feel more connected or...
Sure. Did you go to college? Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went for a while. I was thrown out of high school for a light explosive incident. But the college. Yeah. I went to Rutgers for a couple of years on and off. But it was and then I went to work on Wall Street. I was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange when I was like 20, and I had got into doing comedy, and then in the middle of I had left Wall Street, and then I started doing comedy, and then I bought a small apartment building on Ludlow Street, and then that's how I became, that's the other part of my life.
I saw something in an Instagram where you were talking about building a building.
I'm a developer, for Christ's sake.
You're a developer. So you're a developer and a comedian.
I know it sounds crazy, but yeah.
It's great compared to what a lot of comedians have to do.
It is. You know, I mean, I was in the middle of COVID. It was fucking stressful, but it was...
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's good.
So is it residential or what kind of buildings do you think?
Residential, Mike!
I know we're getting off track. Stupid question.
No, not at all. I like to think perfectly reasonable questions and then aggressively respond to them. Yeah, residential. It's 26, two bedrooms, and then there's a retail on the ground floor.
Wow, that's amazing.
What was your first comedy club? What was the first comedy
club? The first place I ever did comedy was right over, ironically, near the Cellar, but in the Village. It was over at the first show. It was like they had a theater room in this gay bar over off of, I think,
7th Avenue. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And some dude was doing a show and he asked me if I wanted to do it. And then, I was working on the floor of the stock exchange at the time. And then I tried to come up with a few minutes.
And you were hooked or?
No, I wasn't hooked. No, not hooked. It was a really interesting process. And if you grow up feeling like you're not a part of this kind of, I don't know, the world, I mean, without getting too psychoanalytic, I grew up feeling in a challenging place.
It sounds like what's so interesting is if your mom was in a commune where they believe they could be saved by a force field. It sounds like your dad's the kind of guy, you know, from the streets. It doesn't sound like he's going to deal with a lot of bullshit. So did he talk her out of it? How do those two people meet?
You know what I mean? How did
they weren't even married for long, but they decided to live in the same house for the following 10 years after the divorce. My mother lived upstairs. My father lived downstairs. But how did they because it was a confused, crazy operation. It was a struggle for those people. And my mother represented something else. And, and then growing up in that environment, I mean, I couldn't tell kids that I was coming off a commune. You know, working class kids in Jersey are not. They're not pleasant people.
You had to have a sense of humor too, because did kids tease you about being?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, kids were pretty rough early on. There are environments where people, if you allow them to take advantage of you, they'll do so. And so I learned to just let people know. Like, remember they used to have a U-lock that you put your steering wheel on a car.
Long ago,
before before everything became digital. And the theory was that the guy that was going to steal your car would just go to another car without the U-lock on.
Right.
That was like a U-lock. I'm not the roughest guy in the world, but there's an easier fight down the block.
When you first got into comedy, were you looking for a way out? Not just from your, I don't mean like an Iraqi from the streets. I just mean another life.
I was looking for connection and the ability to communicate. I mean, like, where I come from, people stay there generally. And it's not a world where I could have communicated my experience. I mean, coming from this junkyard and I come from a confusing environment. My brother became a psychologist. It was a maddening kind of experience. And comedy, to some degree, I think was an attempt at,
it gave you that outlet.
And even more than an outlet, like a reconciliation to put these two pieces together, mm-hmm. And so it made sense, I think.
And how important was success in it all as a young guy, making it in the traditional sense?
Nothing ever works like that. And luckily, I was fortunate enough to make a significant amount of money early on, even with real estate before any TV stuff in the entertainment business, that I realize there's going to be no significant shift. I mean, wherever you're at, look, if you're over a barrel for expenses and money on the first of the month is the anxiety producer, money will solve that.
Right.
If there are other challenges psychologically that you're dealing with, one needs to look no further than the average comedian who they've seen on television to determine whether or not their life is, you don't have to be in this game for long to realize that money's not going to solve whatever drove you into this business in the first part. Mm-hmm. But obviously money's a good fix if it's a money problem. The problem is that most deep-seated challenges are not money. They're in here.
Right.
Well, that's ask that question too. If you have a job, right? Or if you have a cushion, you won't be as good. You won't be as hungry. Do you agree with that?
No, yes and no. It feels like there are two kinds of ways to think about it. Sometimes the stress and anxiety associated with not having any optionality I think it's based on the individual, because a lot of people, I've heard like in Stern interviews, talking to musicians, and there were a number of people that said, well, I didn't have any other, there was no plan B, so I had to. There's a lot of comedians and showbiz people that did or didn't do well with or without a plan B. And so, I don't know, it feels like, I look at guys that, Greg Giraldo was, a tremendous comedic mind, and he came out of Harvard Law School. So if he wanted a plan B, it was right there in his pocket.
Right.
I think there are a number of experiences like that, but then there are some real hardcore. I mean, it's hard to imagine Dave Attell doing anything but, doing anything but the last spot on a Saturday night when he certainly doesn't have to. So,
Right. It's individual. I think that's a really good way to look at it, because it's your tolerance of fear too, right? I mean, if you are someone who's constantly worried about money and am I going to end up on the streets?
Yeah.
I don't want to be 45 and a greeter at Walmart. Right. Then it's probably not beneficial to say I'm all in. But if you're a little bit more willing to just throw caution to the wind, maybe that is the better way to go. Because I can tell you, I relate to the idea of, I don't think I could just do that. I don't think I could be someone who just says, this is my only option. It's fine when you're 20, but when you're older, that becomes scary as shit.
Yeah, and you know, it seems like the way this business has gone, and correct me if you guys see it any differently, is this whole notion of podcasting is a form of, companies have been doing this for a long time. They call it vertical integration, which is taking a fan base, communicating with them on a weekly basis so that you can then use it to sell tickets. I mean, it used to be when you were all in, it meant you were going after a sitcom or a television show. Mm-hmm. Now it's sort of people taking on a small business mantle and then generating it that way. The mm-hmm. average person posting YouTube clips is not also on a series. They're posting YouTube clips and then generating content on a weekly basis. So I don't know. It would depend what people mean by plan B. Some, like, you know, I was all in. I left Wall Street when I was in my early 20s, and then I was all in at the clubs, you know, 7 days a week or whenever I could get spots because I felt like that was what I needed at the time. But there are a number of people that came out of Gaffigan and there are a lot of people that came out of, you know, law. And Gaffigan was an ad, a copywriter for an ad, you know, a major ad company, stuff like that. It's, I don't know, yeah. Man. It's,
well, I guess at some point you have to say, you know what, I'm going to leave this job. I mean, you had to make a decision at some point after a certain amount of years of doing comedy. You were like, I'm done with this. This is my full-time job. I mean, how long did that take? And, it didn't take
long because I figured I had to just that schedule. You know, it's like early on, you're just trying to get stage time. And so that often requires being out. Just the logistics are challenging because you got to be out late at night. You know, it's like, I mean, so it, I don't know, inside of a year and a half, 2 years after kind of starting stand up. I mean, that's mostly what
I remember too, the days of, you know, guys would do showcases. Everybody wanted to get on, right? They wanted to get that premium blend. They wanted to get 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But traditionally comedy has always been a woodshed kind of thing. You know, it takes a long time. You have to put in your time, but today's comics, how do you feel about easier fame, quicker fame? Do you think
I don't know, man. I wonder how that ecosystem works. You know, when I see guys posting thumbnails with content that's, I find relatively weak, I'm not going to name names, but there is something. If everybody is a de facto network, right? It used to be there were gatekeepers. There were at NBC, CBS, ABC. And if you did the Tonight Show, then maybe there was not, you know, it's like, and now, the upside of having no gatekeepers that anybody can produce content and put it online. And the downside is there's a lot of bullshit that people put online as content. And so it feels like it goes like that, but there's a lot of people developing a following. You know, if there's no like casting agent or line producer, you know, talent coordinator at some television based situation, the upside is you don't have to deal with that bullshit. But the downside is everybody and their fucking mother can post a link to some horrendous content.
Right, right.
And so it just becomes overwhelming. But
you know what's interesting as well is it's a different skill. I mean, being a comedian
is totally different.
A skill in itself, right? Totally we all know different. That. But then to say, well, I'm going to have a TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, following. I mean,
a vertically integrated social media marketing network company. I mean, it's that and that, and then track that and then track that. And then at some point you also have to write some material, but it is, it's different in that way. No doubt about it.
And I think it can feel disempowering, even though you're right, the gatekeepers are gone, but there's this need to fill the void. You even said it. A lot of stuff is not very interesting, very funny, but you got to do it. It's like a machine. You got to keep the algorithm aware of you. You want to make sure you're out there. And it's this hamster wheel of insanity.
It's a hamster wheel.
But when we started in comedy, I was a comic for a long time up there. Yeah. And you didn't sign up for this, is my point.
No, some people love it.
Some people love it, and that's great. But this part of the job, because I see you're not, we both checked out your Instagram and your website.
I don't fucking, listen, there's got to be a way. It seems like the fundamental challenge now is to thread the needle between engaging in social media. So the cost benefit analysis is that the cost is psychological It's your time. It's your energy. It's your ability to generate peace of mind and live with yourself. The benefit is ticket sales, you know, and engagement in the business. And so the modern problem or the contemporary problem in comedy is going to be walking the line between peace of mind and engaging with other people. I don't do that for the most part. I follow zero people on Instagram. And I, because I don't go on it, there's no sense me following somebody and acting like I'm watching what they're posting. And then, although I'm considering following Dan Adamant because he's a lunatic, but no, and on Twitter, it's like, I had, when I was doing all that Chelsea shit, I had like, probably up to 40,000 over the course of a couple of years. And then I just canceled it because it felt so noisy. It was not a good business move on my account. But I've made a few million dollars doing, you know, between television and investment, I've bought myself out of some of that social media rest. World. So I am not a good example to follow. I'm someone who started to value peace of mind very highly. And before I engaged in development,
right.
I was in Los Angeles looking around going, the amount of energy devoted to generating relatively, how good can your content be if it's weekly? I'm not talking about a weekly podcast where you talk to somebody. There's wacky comedic clips, and then there's YouTube, and then there's cross-interfacing with TikTok, and then vertically integrating with Instagram, and then, you know, and then there's the road schedule, and then there's trying to generate auditions. And after a while, it's a weird balancing act that diminishes one's, you know.
Sure. And I don't think I think it's funny you said you're a bad example. I don't think you're a bad example. The fact that you took your mental health and self-worth over not engaging in Twitter is not a bad example.
No, you're right. I'm an excellent example. If you don't want to be a lunatic, then you should follow me.
Well, but that's a part of what the world is now, right? You've heard this before, I'm sure. We're all the Truman Show, where everyone's the starring in their own movie. We are all in our own Truman Show, right?
Yes.
And everyone's fighting for eyeballs and fighting for likes and follows. And if you need that for your self-worth, you'll go mental, right? You'll go mental.
What you just said was said by the author who he ended up taking his own life. So that's ironic, but it was a tremendous commentary on how we generate peace of mind and self-awareness. It was David Foster Wallace.
Oh, yeah.
David Foster Wallace gave a speech, you know.
The Infinite Jest, right?
He wrote The Infinite Jest among some other books, but I'm not sure what a genius is, but sometimes you know it when you read it. I'm pretty sure he was a genius. And the anyway, he gives a commencement speech at a graduation. It's worth listening to. It's on YouTube. It's like 20 minutes or something.
I'll check that out, man.
Yeah. And he just talks about, if you really start to go down the rabbit hole of worshiping anything like, you know, fame, sort of general popularity, like, it's always going to lead you in the opposite direction of yourself. And so the challenge would be maintaining equilibrium between engaging with the marketplace, but never losing yourself in it. And that's a very, tight
rope. Well, I mean, in comedy business too, Dub, I mean, you were defined by what you did. You know, you're defined by your shows. You know, guys always compare notes. Hey, I got this, I got that going on. I mean, it's hard to not engage in it if you.
It is. It's impossible to not engage.
Well, how do you balance it?
I don't balance
it. Well, you do, but you do, because you even say you've got other business, you've got.
Oh, well, in terms of life, the way
all of it, because you're still a comedian, you're right. You're still
absolutely.
You're just there. You're absolutely not engaging in social media intentionally. You could. So what is the, are you finding you can balance what you're comfortable with?
Yes. On a relative basis. Yes. It's like, if I really wanted to drive sort of gigs on the road and go out and try to turn over another hour. And I could engage in, you know, social media more actively. I literally have been involved in the critical part of real estate development now for a couple of years. So throughout COVID, but it's, So that's my balance was 90% show biz, 10% biz for years. And then it became my experience of doing television was that the levels of insecurity associated with Hollywood and those jobs and I almost don't blame them. When you're at a party and they're looking around to see who showed up in the room, it used to be you take offense at somebody doing that. And now I experience a degree of pity because having been around a lot of people that make a living in television, they're generally very worried that there's not going to be another job. Mm-hmm. And so even people that are making what seems to be a lot of money, it's not a sustainable revenue stream. And you also lose a lot of it to the government. Between manager, attorney, agent, and the government, you're talking about 45% net. So even if you're able to generate significant income, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. Showbiz is very bad for keeping a significant amount of the dough. And so there's the actual financial part of it. And then there's the just generating auditions and getting another job. And what was a little disheartening for me is when you saw people that had been famous television people when I was younger, at the same audition you are, you know, trying to get the same job.
Right.
Not necessarily bad, but it does put things into perspective as to how the business really works. I'm not commenting on anybody's art. You know, it's like Apatow is a real artist, man. If that guy weren't being paid, he would still be writing on a notepad somewhere.
Right.
You're trying to balance your life. Right. And it's,
do you feel it's inherently unhealthy then?
Excellent question. Yes. Inherently unhealthy until you can find ballast in that, right? It's clearly inherently unhealthy to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what other people will like relative to, you know, if your self-esteem is connected to that, it is inevitably going to be very challenging to find peace of mind, right? So in that context, it would be inherently unhealthy if your self-esteem is attached to it.
Right.
If your sense of self isn't as connected to it, and that's very challenging in execution, it's easy to say, you know, then you can find healthier ways to engage with social media without it reflecting on you in a destructive manner. In which case that would represent some form of equilibrium, but
it feels like that can only come in with age. I think anyone, when we were kids, I can't speak for you guys, but when you're in your 20s, maybe even your 30s, that's a lot to ask of someone younger.
Tremendous amount to ask. I would argue it's nearly impossible to walk that line without a lot of sort of work and awareness. And obviously we have to compare ourselves to ourselves. I mean, let's be better than we were yesterday. But the more time you spend in comparison to the rest of the world, the more time you'll spend unhappy. Those are hard-won lessons. And like you said, as a young person, it's going to be really tough to do that. So in the macro scope, I'm worried about the world. And as it relates to just this business, I would still be worried about those minds. And I don't find that age is a panacea either. I find that there's a lot of hyper insecurity as people, you know what I mean? It's like, a more mature mind is more capable of balance, but hard, man.
Age by itself is nothing by itself. Yeah. I think age and working at, learning who you are and learning how you can best, you said, find the ballast. It comes with that. But we all know people who are 60 and morons. I mean, there's no way you can give age by itself, but it's just, you talk to someone who's younger, you try and make the same mistakes you made. And there's, you can't explain it away. There's not enough, there are no words that can give the wisdom you get when you have had the experiences, you know, we've had.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, Doug, too, you're super smart. Like, I love comics because it's been a part of my business, watching it and knowing it. But I have always thought of comics as not listeners. How do I say this?
Not self-absorbed.
Yeah, I always felt like they're self-absorbed, sometimes assholes, narcissists, whatever. But I realized over the years, guys are super smart. They had careers before. They've thought about different things. I just never really took the time to say, hey, let me find out what's going on, right?
I think it's true, but I think you need to be a little bit. I think if you want to be a world famous comedian, if that's your goal, it has to be about you all the time. I'm not saying that's right or it's healthy, but it seems like that's where the focus needs to be. I don't know if you agree with that, Dove.
No, it's a good question. No, look, there's two different questions. There's what kind of person do you want to be? And then there's the world famous thing. I think, you know, Jim Carrey has said some interesting stuff about this. It's like, I don't know. I think there aren't too many people who have pulled off the kind of world famous and also seemingly balanced and happy. I gotta think it's relatively possible. You think of a guy like Tom Hanks as the obvious consideration. I don't know Tom Hanks, but you think that he seems to have got it dialed in reasonably well. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not a good life to spend too much time thinking about yourself in the context of whether or not everyone will like you or getting as many people as possible to like you. It's antithetical to what we are, which is trying to develop our own sense of ourselves. If we're genuinely concerned with how the world is going to see us all the time, that's going to be antithetical to happiness. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly there's, if you can separate the notion that you're a product and try to really move that product in the marketplace, it seems like,
I think, yeah. But like you said, and when you talk about people in Hollywood looking around the room, but not being insulted by it or even totally putting your nose up at it. It's because it's the natural course. I've met people who had normal jobs and then they decided to become an actor or whatever. And they instantly become so much more self-absorbed. It's always about them. And am I going to make it? And I wonder for someone at your level, and you've had a great deal of success. I don't know if you consider that yourself, but you know, I've seen you on Crashing. I thought you were great.
Yeah, on TV and all that shit.
Right. Do you still want the next level? Are you still pursuing, I want to get to the next phase, which isn't normal, right?
No, you know, look, it's funny. I mean, for me, it's a more challenging question because a lot of the things that people associate with the next phase, unless it's creative, are money. And the truth is, I've kind of dialed in a lifestyle where I have enough. I have enough, and I'm not really sort of engaged by material. I don't know. I keep a car in Manhattan. I live in a nice building. I mean, I have the things that I don't know that I'm that motivated to go back out to Los Angeles and try to pitch television shows. And so the idea of being engaged in sort of finance and, you know, the capital stack associated with development while still engaging in a creative world seems like a better balance for me. But clearly I'm leaving a lot of energy on the table if world fame were the objective. I'm not going to get there with the attitude I have. I just don't think that that would be a good objective. If the objective is, you know, if you're Jim Carrey early on and you're a really talented dude and you're really trying to experience all of this, two things come to mind. You know, Jim Carrey said, he goes, the fame game, he said, this was really sort of thoughtfully communicated. He said, if you want to become really famous, you need to become an avatar of yourself. And what he meant, avatar meaning you're not going to talk about your politics, your opinions, a number of things. You're going to be very aware of your social interface, what you're projecting. He said, if you then become really famous, you're going to have a choice to make. Either you have to kill yourself kill your inner self and become your avatar, like some like a Ryan Seacrest or something, or maybe he doesn't actually have any opinions. I don't know, but you're either kill yourself and become your avatar in anticipation of greater and greater fame. The problem is that's a rabbit hole. There is no end to fame. There's no pullout. The challenges with those personalities go on and on and on. And so that doesn't seem like a very successful place to me,
right?
Unless you can be happy, unless you can find happiness. Or Jim Carrey said, and which is what Carrey did, is you can kill your avatar and become yourself. And then if you can still maintain that showbiz momentum,
that balance. Do so.
And if you notice, Jim Carrey hasn't been a lead in a big movie in about 15 years, but he's still fine and he saved money. And like, I would much rather be that guy than somebody who's driven by world fame. It's easier to say because I've made enough dough that I'm comfortable enough to say it, but I still think I'd want to be that guy. I think false gods generate false kind of results ultimately in terms of your own mind.
Right.
I have yet to hear about anybody that was super driven to become famous, becoming famous, and then that working for them psychologically.
I know quite a few people, but I mean, yeah. I don't think you can be in a very...
No, you're right. Being balanced.
Don't get me wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of people look at entertainment, especially I think as kids, more especially the next generation, which is not their fault, it's the technology, but it's almost like the church, right? It's like this worship of fame and fame feels old. Fame feels like 70s, 80s. Now it's this, I guess it's the word fame, but it's adulation, it's clicks, it's likes, it's money, it's you're 19.
It's all the same parts of the brain that it's those parts that release serotonin based on
fire off.
Yeah, which is why generally the healthier people that grew up with a lot of love aren't driven in those same ways. Like growing up with a chip on your shoulder, a lot of musicians talk about it. It's in constant showbiz biographies where you grow up with this chip. People didn't like me. They were, you know, and then I'm going to make everybody sort of love me. But the problem is the emptiness is still remains. I mean, what I'm saying is the oldest is really showbiz cliche.
It's the life cliche because anything you do, you have these goals. And this is just in general. They say this even about Olympians, which is going on right now.
Yeah.
You get it, and then it always lands with now what? Because the it's the material world, right? Like, you know.
There's no end to that. And if you're it's funny, it's like I had a deal with my buddy was Renee Zellweger's writing partner. And you realize that, and having known directors and some real Hollywood people, the fame thing, there is no there. You follow me? It can't be. And the reason for that is like, if you worship fame, you'll never be young enough, pretty enough. It will never be enough because there's going to be another guy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but it's not going to solve that stuff. And so it never does. I mean, all of these lives, I don't even think it's about self-absorption. I think a guy like Judd Apatow, I think regardless of whether or not there was a lot of money or fame, I think he'd be doing the same thing.
Right.
He'd be doing the same thing he was always.
Yeah. Right. He just grew up in at the right time, at the right place where that can make you a lot of success.
No,
but if he was born in the 1800s, he'd be writing plays maybe or something. Right?
No, that's exactly.
No, that's a good point. That's a very good point though. I mean, I think when you love it too, when you have a passion for it, no matter what, this is what you're going to be doing.
Yes. It's like when you said there's no there with fame, it's true. There's no finish line. There's no, you made it. You know how people say you made it.
Come I was on, thinking, Netflix. When is there's that? There's no making it. I read Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, and it really stuck with me. He said, think about your decisions as though you're making them as though you were 80 years old on your deathbed, looking back at your life. Think about every decision you make through that. You'll probably make less shallow, less bad decisions, but it's really hard to hold on to oneself in the age of social media. It's probably always been hard.
I mean, Doug, let me ask you this. What do you think about management agents and all that stuff?
It's funny. It's like, you know, I've had good and bad experiences with all of them, but you know, the manager game, it's an ethereal business. You know what I mean? Ethereal, like it's sort of neither here nor there, and you can't put your finger on it. So you can talk to somebody that's had a manager for years, and they may be able to point at some upside. Most of the time, people's experience is, well, you know, I have a manager to make sure that my agent is doing what the agent is supposed to do, you know, and then you have an attorney to make sure that the contract developed by the agency is the right con. I mean, it's a weird business in that regard. And if you're in a business where the probability of work is low and the probability of unemployment is high, it's a perfect storm of insecurity. And so a manager comes along and go, I think you're great. I'm going to be on top of this game. I want you to be the next fill in the blank. I'm going to keep an eye on that agent of yours. And we're going to continue to, it's a very right place to, if you have the psychology of a pimp, it's a very, very good place to do it. That being said, there are people who have had excellent experiences with right. managers. An agent, you need to get the audition. And so I don't know any way around that if you're going after auditions, you know, or, you know, personal appearance agent for some road gigs. But yeah, managers are, there's, it's more gray area with the
manager. Do you still audition? Are you out there doing that? You do a lot of, you've done a lot of television.
I've done a lot of television, but I told my agent that at this point, I don't have time to audition for guest stars. What I mean by time is it's not really true. It's not a meaningful enough gig. The probability of a guest star gig going somewhere relative to what I've already done is low enough that I'm willing to forego any part of those auditions for peace of mind. So I'm a bad representative if you want to be an actor. I used to go out on everything, but I've been a series regular on several shows. If it's not a part that could be in the lead or in at least a 6 to 12 episode arc, I don't want to even look at it. I'm not going to put myself on tape. I'm not going to spend the time, and the money isn't meaningful enough to me. But I'm a bad example of that.
But you know what? You're not a bad example because it's a healthy example. I mean, I don't think the good example is someone who says, I'll do anything, anywhere. You know, you want me to be in a bunny outfit?
I'm not talking about, suffering and dignity as a good example. I mean, you know, I remember like Dustin Hoffman going, this is it. You know, I will do this. Rain or shine, whatever need. And you got that sense that any gig would be a gig he would have taken. You know, it's like, you do need some of that in a business where the probability is so low. And mm-hmm. then at a certain point, if you've earned it,
right,
and you feel like you can start saying no, right. But that's a very subjective call. You know, I mean, at right. this point.
Right. Maybe my example was too extreme, but I think having the whether it's self-worth or, or just mental health to say, you know what, this is where I'm at. Sure. And I don't
dignity,
need, that's
dignity,
fantastic.
You're 100% right. And that has to be foremost in your consideration, consistent with Frankel, you know, who said, think about the decision you're about to make as though you're making it from the perspective of an 80-year-old on your own deathbed. Mm-hmm. And looking back at the decision you made, you know, there's a fine line between, you know, doing something that you're not totally into and doing something that diminishes your self-worth and your dignity. And you got to hold on to dignity at all costs.
Right. Do you still love the craft on stage? Do you still love coming up with a joke, or is it a change?
Yeah. It's a fun Rubik's Cube, trying to find a way to communicate this thing that you experience. Yeah. And also, like, I don't have much of a social life outside of it, you know? And so it's like, the craft is still really interesting, and the people that you interface with. I mean, it's like, it's a lot more interesting than people I'm interfacing with in the world of business. You know, right. I was on the line with some private equity guys. They're smart guys and they've made a lot of money, but it's relatively dull, you know, sort of the interactions. I mean, on a relative basis, relative to, you know, running into David Tell, it's dull, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Are there younger comics now you see coming up that kind of remind you of yourself? Or
sorry about
see
that,
some of the guys, I don't watch a lot of comedy, and so whoever's on me before I go on or on right after I go on, I'll see. So that's a lot of people. Yeah, there's some fun. Like, I mean, what pops in my mind is that dude Daniel Simonsen over at the Comedy Cellar. He's a new guy. And he's from Norway. And when you hear him, like, it's real distinct, you know? And so experiencing a new voice when you hear it is always interesting. I mean, I always enjoy watching a Dan Natterman.
Right, right. It's, me too, it's, man. I thought he was always uniquely funny.
Yeah, so, he's a unique guy.
So yeah. Saying all that, do you go back on the road a lot? Do you want to be on the road? I mean, it doesn't
sound like I don't need to be on the road a lot. If I'm working on an hour or something, then you got to go out there to do the hour. But I get enough spots in the city where I'm able to generate material and work on what I do and stay tight without doing a lot of time on the road. And so as a business consideration, I don't.
So how do you deal with your manager on this? Like when he says, well, I want you to make me more money. I need you to feed me.
No, nobody's going to say anything to me because I won't because the answer is no. Listen, if it's a significant paycheck associated with something, if he said, look, there's a part on a cop show like I was doing on NBC and that, you know, I want you to go out on that. And I'm like, I don't want to go out. He's like, come on, go out. You know, I'll go out on something like that. But to go out to, you know, the average gig.
I mean, at the end of the day, you're still a money-making machine, though. You know, you still.
Yeah, no, that's what the percentage, that's what the commission game is. Yeah. And so they'll decide whether or not, if I become too independent, say no too much, you know, you can fire me.
Yeah. So when you lived in L.A., what was the moment you thought, enough of this, I'm going back to New York?
I was reading the tea leaves and I saw what's going on. I saw the beginning of, you know, that kind of social media craze. And it's
what year was that then?
What year? Feel good to me. You know, probably I think I'd say 10 years ago, you could feel it really coming. I'm not sure how that chronology works, but I would say you could start to feel it. I didn't know the degree of importance or, you know, what the world of, you know, the podcast, like, I didn't know what forms it would take, but I was working on, you know, off and on TV projects. And then I had development deals and then I'd come off and on some guest star role. And like, you start to understand the business and given other opportunities I had in business in New York, I decided that it would be a better place for me psychologically and in some ways financially, though I would give up some probability in terms of the fame game. For me, LA had more connection to television in that world, but it's a strange low probability world. You know, it's right. Like, if I got a TV show today on Netflix, one, if it's not a specific type of comedy role, it's unlikely that you're going to sell that many more tickets based on that role in the first place. It's not like there's an immediate correlation. 20 years ago, if you were on Seinfeld, you can go out and sell tickets. It's not that way. It's much more niche audiences. Those shows average 1 year, maybe 2 years. Three seasons is a good run for those. I mean, Apatow's Crashing on HBO was a grating success. I don't know how financially successful it was. That made, what, three seasons?
Yeah. You were great on that, by the way. I loved you on that.
Thanks. But on NBC, I was doing that cop show. Yeah, whatever. On NBC, doing that cop show, that went three seasons. I did two of those seasons. These are short-lived jobs, you know? And so,
I mean, ideally, what would be your ideal situation far as to get you to say, I would love to do this for 5 years?
Oh, yeah. Like a really interesting cop show in New York, you know, where I can go and do stand up at night and like a good one with an interesting role, that would be fun. But I'm trying to think of the people that have actually done that. And
like Richard Belzer, when he was doing that.
Sure. Like, yeah, but that's lightning in a bottle, man. A show that runs for 20 years. You know, you're talking about a show that started, you know, a few decades ago.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I don't know that happens anywhere.
Right.
That can happen in today's environment with 200 different TV shows across five streaming platforms. Like when you had four networks, you had long running shows, you know? So
it's different now, with the streaming.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Changes everything.
It's totally different. It used to be, you know, I mean, you get a show on HBO or NBC. I mean, I had two of them at the same time. They both lasted three seasons and they were both critical I mean, they were both relative hits. It's not like they were tanking. Three seasons. And so once you amortize that, I'm not talking about creatively. I'm talking about if you break that down money-wise, I can just compare it to other ventures and go, it's just not a lot of
it. But how about the creative side of it? Did you get a lot out of it? I mean, were you loving it at the time? Did you enjoy the process of shooting?
Love is a strong word, but it's I heard a really interesting actor once say, the only thing I like about this business takes place between action and cut. And acting can be engaging, but the hours and hours and hours of waiting and makeup and the business associated with it, like, I don't, who the fuck loves that? I remember hearing on the radio, like, you get to go to the set and be a spectator on a movie. I was like, if you've ever been to a fucking TV set, it is the most boring place in the world to watch anything.
Yeah, it's like watching paint dry.
As an actor working with Ray Liotta on a cop show in the times where I got to have genuine scene and go back and forth and bounce impulses and do all that psychological stuff, that was very engaging. But those times are here, mm-hmm. you know, those times are few and far between.
So you would never, so comparing acting to stand up, which you can't really do, they're very different. I'd even argue they're the opposite ends. One is engaging with someone else, like connecting with someone else. And stand up is much more about, it's much more internal and pushing what you believe out to the audience. You know, you control the room. It's more controlling.
Stand-ups would be much better actors. You know, you hear about all these stand-ups going out on auditions. They're generally not good actors, but they're not good because they couldn't be good.
Right.
They're not good because they can't listen. Like, you have to shut down yourself. And the way to really make a scene funny isn't to try to be funny. It's to really listen to the other person. It's listening that's more important than the response. And so, that's at least my experience.
We're narrowing down our time, but we loved having you, man. And I appreciate your time, man. This is amazing. Yeah, of course.
All right, Dove, thank you so much, man. This was awesome.
All right, guys.
I really appreciate it.
All right, good night, man. Bye, guys.
Appreciate it. Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, Mo, let them know how they can support us.
Make sure to subscribe to Comedy Anatomy and give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram @Comedy Anatomy and on Twitter @Comedy_Anatomy.